Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In budget-crunched California, the institution for men in Chino was just one of 33 California prisons stuffed with twice its capacity of inmates. Last weekend, it exploded. With just two guards for every 200 prisoners, there was little to stop a bloody, race-tinged rampage that left 175 prisoners injured and a scene of maimed bodies and burned-out destruction. With states across the country facing giant budget deficits and a bad economy, eyes are turning to America's world-leading incarceration rate and how to pay for it in strapped times. This hour on Point, the Chino Riot and its message on America's gigantic prison population. You can join the conversation. Is your state struggling to cover the cost of all its prisoners? Is it letting prisoners go? Is it time to rethink our incarceration rates or hang tough, whatever the cost? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Los Angeles is Carol Williams, legal affairs reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She has been out to Chino and the ruins there. Carol, welcome back to On Point. What happened at Chino, Carol? Hello, Carol? It looks like we lost the line for just a moment. Also with us from California today is Kara Dansky. She's joined us now from Berkeley, California. She's executive director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center and a lecturer in law. Kara, thanks for being there.
Thanks for having me.
I hope we get Carol back. She's actually been out to the kind of smoldering ruins. But give us, in a nutshell, what happened in these 4 hours of rampage at Chino, Carol?
Well, as far as I understand, the actual cause of the riot is still under investigation. There's a lot of speculation, but I haven't heard anything in the way of specifics about what precisely caused this riot, meaning what exactly was the spark. It's important for your listeners to know that we need to view this riot in a context of the California prison overcrowding crisis generally, which you've alluded to.
Mm-hmm. We've got Carol Williams back with us now from the LA Times. Carol, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Can you just lay out for us what happened in these 4 hours at Chino, as far as we know?
Well, the prison authorities got word on Thursday that there was something brewing among the inmates at Chino and imposed a lockdown. And then about 48 hours later, rioting erupted in one of the most overcrowded areas of the Chino prison, the Reception Center West. And for about 4 hours, the guards were unable to enter the facility. The inmates had taken control of it. They were throwing everything out of the dormitories, setting fire to bedding. There was, you know, handmade weapons were used to attack. It was reported to be initially a brawl between Latino and Black gang members at the prison, but it eventually engulfed the entire facility. About 1,600 inmates live in that part of the prison, and they were all involved in the brawl at some point.
We read about broken glass being used to gouge out eyes and broken water pipes and just every sort of mayhem there in those 4 hours. I mean, you've been there and seen the aftermath. What did it look like?
It was total destruction. The dormitory where it began was set fire to, and it's beyond repair. It's a charred wreckage. The other dormitories in the same area were trashed. Everything was thrown out. The windows were broken. The facilities, the toilets and sinks were ripped out of the walls. The TV room was, you know, trashed. It was it's going to take a long time to clean up, and some of the dormitories are beyond repair.
You write about bloodstains all over and a really frightening scene there. What were the conditions before, just in terms of overcrowding, before this broke out?
Well, Chino is one of the reception prisons where returning parole violators are processed, and because that is now a huge part of the prison population in California, it's where the overcrowding is concentrated. And you know, it's hot, it's crowded, they have nothing to do, there's very little work in the California prisons, so the inmates are compelled to just sit around all day and get on each other's nerves, and this is one example that has been warned of, that the violence is just brewing in all of the prisons here.
And overall in California, I read from you that you have 158,000 prisoners in facilities designed for 84,000. And the cost of that is hitting California hard at a time when it's up against such terrible red ink in its state budget. There's talk of letting out some thousands of prisoners. Have I got that right, Carol?
Yes, and there's also a federal court order that the population be reduced because the state for years has not been providing constitutional care. The medical and mental health facilities have been under par for so long that it's contributed to the general decline in health and environment in the prisons, to the extent that unless they release, the court has said, 43,000 prisoners over the next 2 years, they will be unable to bring services up to constitutional standards. There's also pressure from the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to reduce the population significantly to bring down the costs. The state has budgeted there's $1.2 billion in cuts that have been ordered to a $10 billion budget, so they have to cut more than 10% of the costs, and that's going to be very difficult because they've already cut rehabilitation programs, education, vocational. There's not much to cut except the cost of maintaining them and keeping them in the prisons.
Carol Williams with the LA Times. Thank you very much for joining us with your report from Chino Prison, Carol. Thank you. Kara Dansky in Berkeley, can California afford its prison population?
Well, that's precisely the question that legislators are having to ask themselves right now. As the reporter just mentioned, legislators and the governor are right now trying to find $1.2 billion in cuts that they can make to the corrections budget. Our prison population is as high as it is, specifically because of policies that have been implemented over the course of the last several decades that really were designed to do nothing but send more and more people to prison. So in some sense, this was foreseeable, and it will be hard, I think, to continue to justify the numbers of our prison population, especially now when we're facing some really serious budget cuts.
Right across the country, states are grappling with this, and a lot of them have begun to find ways to try to loosen up and get some prisoners out of those prisons because it's just so expensive to keep them there. On the other hand, we've come through a long time when prison rates have gone up very sharply. We're way up at the top of the world pyramid, for better or worse, on incarceration rates, but our crime rates have gone down a lot. So is this a situation where states have to stop paying for something that's working, Kara? How do you see it?
Well, so a couple of decades ago, basically in the 1960s and 70s, what we saw were a lot of increasing crime rates. Now, what's interesting about that is that before that time, our country didn't do a very good job of keeping track of data on crime rates. There was a crime commission formed in the late 1960s. One of its main recommendations was to start keeping data on national crime rates. We didn't really know much about it before then. So around that time, we started collecting the data and we started seeing some spikes in crime rates. As a consequence, in part of that, through the 1980s and 90s, we saw states across the country, but in particular in California, building more and more prisons, enacting increasingly severe punishment laws, and sending more and more people to prison. Now, the precise question that you ask has to do with the relationship between incarceration rates and crime rates.
Mm-hmm.
Most researchers who have studied the question find that increasing incarceration results in a little bit of drop in crime rate, but that other drops in crime rate that we saw that we've seen recently are due to other factors, like, for example, the economy in the 1990s, increasing wages, decreasing unemployment, things like that. So there's more and more consensus growing that continuing along these lines of increasing incarceration is not going to help us anymore in decreasing our crime rates.
I'm looking at a report. This is from last year, but it must be roughly the same now. The U.S. has less than 5% of the world's population, but almost a quarter of the world's prisoners, an incarceration rate just way up there beyond anybody else. 2.3 million criminals behind bars, more than any other country. 751 people in prison for every 100,000 in population. Or if you count only adults, one in every 100 Americans locked up. I mean, Russia has fewer, is closest, but still fewer. England has only 151 per 100,000. All population. Germany, 88. Japan, 63, compared to 751 for us. That's expensive.
It's expensive, and it's really quite extraordinary. The United States uses more than any other country mandatory prison sentences. We employ longer prison sentences under policies like three strikes and mandatory life sentences. And as I said earlier, by implementing these kinds of policies, we knew, or at least we should have been able to foresee, that we would have the kinds of incarceration rates that we're now seeing.
What were you thinking as you saw the scenes out of Chino, Kara?
Well, it's terrifying, as Ms. Williams alluded to, the flames coming out of the buildings, the broken glass, and the extent of the injuries. On the other hand, people in California have been predicting this for quite some time. The governor of California declared a state of emergency 3 years ago now, and we're still operating under that very state of emergency, predicting that there would be a major riot at one of California's prisons. The Prison Guard Union, in fact, has been saying for a long time that overcrowding is likely to lead to something like this. They're, of course, concerned about the safety and welfare of their membership. So this was not entirely unforeseeable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about California's Chino prison riot last weekend and the challenge in hard times of paying the cost of huge prison populations nationwide. Kara Dansky is with us from Berkeley, California, executive director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center there. With us now from Washington, D.C. is Mark Maurer. He's executive director of the Sentencing Project. It's a nonprofit that advocates for criminal justice reform. He's author of Race to Incarcerate. Mark Maurer, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, it's good to be here.
What did you read in the Chino story, Mark?
Well, it's a very frightening picture, certainly, all around. As Kara's pointed out, certainly, we in some ways have seen this coming, you know, with the dramatic, you know, explosion of the prison population in recent decades, even in the best administered prisons, that we have a problem just waiting to explode. And it's tragic it happened in Chino. You know, could it happen in other places? Unfortunately, it could. It's not only the overcrowding, but clearly that's a very significant component of what we're seeing there.
How are states responding to the tremendous budget pressures? I mean, billions and billions that states don't know where to get in the coming fiscal year, and the cost of their prisons. What have you seen nationally, Mark, about who's doing what?
Well, in some ways, it's an opportunity to do what many people have been recommending for a couple of decades now, and that is that we have what is essentially a bloated prison system. We vastly increased the numbers of nonviolent offenders in prison, particularly drug offenders. We've now got 500,000 people in prisons and jails serving time for a drug offense. This is compared to about 40,000 back in 1980. Prisons have become the new mental institutions. One of every six people in prison is a history of mental illness. And so keeping people in prison for excessively long prison terms does remarkably little for actually controlling crime, and yet it makes it exceedingly difficult for them to return to the community successfully, to get the kind of treatment they may need to deal with the underlying problems. And so if we can reduce the number of people in prison, make the decisions we need about public safety, we may may be able to end up with a much more cost-effective approach to public safety by investing more on the front end, prevention, treatment, supervision in the community, and reserving prison space for people who are truly violent, truly dangerous, and that's what prisons should be for.
Kara, are you watching across the country? I'm reading reports here from Kentucky, Michigan, South Carolina, other states, where they're looking to, as California's been mandated to reduce their prison populations by, in some cases, letting people go, redefining or just figuring out new ways. What trends are you seeing there, Kara, to try to duck some of that huge bill?
Well, two things in particular I'm seeing emerge across the country. One has to do with finding creative ways to divert nonviolent drug offenders from prison. And so states are finding some really interesting ways to do this that involve diverting nonviolent drug offenders into things like drug courts or into treatment programs not related to drug courts, keeping nonviolent drug offenders on probation instead of locking them up in jail or prison. So finding better ways of dealing with nonviolent drug offenders is one major thing that states are looking at. Another set of areas that states are looking at has to do with reentry, and in particular, the state of Missouri is being really praised for some of the work that it's doing in constructing reentry centers. And the purpose of these is to take inmates out of the state institutions shortly before the end of their sentence and put them back into the community in a facility where they can reacquaint themselves with their families, sometimes enroll in the treatment programs that they need, be able to get jobs that they need, and so really use it as a transition period to prepare them for their reentry into the community. The whole area of reentry into the community is something that we haven't paid enough attention to, although it's getting more and more attention in the last few years.
I'm reading here J. Michael Brown, Secretary of the Kentucky Justice and Public Safety Cabinet, noting that Kentucky led the country last year in the rate of inmate growth. It's 12% in 1 year over the previous year. And he writes, if insanity is repeating the same behavior while expecting different results, then continuing to allow our prison population to spiral out of control without scrutiny or demonstrated public benefit would be at best irresponsible and possibly insane. Strong words there from Kentucky. Let me get a call here from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Thanks. I just wanted to say that I think that part of what we're experiencing in the prison thing is an American melody straight through, and that's that we're given to excesses. 40 years ago, I had a friend when I was a World Council of Churches fellow in Germany who came to New York to study, and he was Switzerland. And when he came back, I said, Jan, what did you learn about the States? And he said, well, it's clearly a very wealthy country, but not in the ways you like to think. He said, there are three things that reflect the affluence of America. One is the excessive garbage you produced. No other country can afford that. The amount of pet food in stores when people around the world are hungry. And he said, third, no other country can afford to put the number of people in prison and have them non-productive, as you do. And I think we're just reaping the whirlwind now of bad policy and vindictiveness in the case of prisons.
Mark, let's pick that up. And Jim, thanks for your call. Mark Maurer, how about it? I mean, do we basically have a mismatch between our policy and what we can now afford? Because, on the other hand, crime isn't without cost either. Crime imposes real cost on the country.
I think many states, once believed that they could build prisons and also build college classrooms, and now it's pretty clear we can't do both, and you've got to make some difficult choices there. And the question is, how do we plan for the next generation? Do we want to be building more prisons for them? Do we want to educate our population? And I think in many ways, we need to invest in the future, and we need to be smarter about how we use prisons. People who are locked up because they're long-term violent offenders, yes, it's expensive, but very few people would worry about the cost there. But when we lock up lower-level drug offenders for 5- and 10-year mandatory prison terms, as has become very common, we have remarkably little impact on the drug problem. Those people are generally replaced on the streets very easily, and unless we address the demand for drugs, we're really just chasing after the problem with very little impact. So we have to be much more strategic about how we use prison, our sentencing policies, our drug policies, a much broader approach than we've taken in recent decades.
I'm looking here at a report earlier this year out of Michigan, where Governor Jennifer Granholm was struggling to close then a $1.6 billion budget hole, looking to release as many as 12,000 inmates. And the Michigan Department of Corrections Director Patricia Caruso says it's a time to rethink policy on prison. She said, if we choose to spend all our resources locking people up, even knowing there's no correlation between how long people stay and whether or not they'll reoffend, then we're not making good decisions. We're making emotional ones, she said. Kara Danski, I'm looking, that seems to be this issue of how long seems to be at work in California's plans. Schwarzenegger's outline of how they might reduce these numbers, you know, taking a moving things that have been felonies and making them not petty thefts, for example, writing bad checks, receiving stolen property, no longer to be felonies, generally not published with punishable by state prison sentences, or vehicle thefts. Stealing a car, this was proposed anyway, wouldn't automatically be considered a felony if the car was less than $2,500, or grand theft reduced. You know, stealing an item valued at more than $400 would not automatically be grand theft. Up to $2,500, is that the kind of shift that you're looking at in California, Kara?
Well, the proposals that you're naming are part of a plan that the governor put forth to reduce the budget by $1.2 billion, as we discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. It's not clear what's happening with that plan right now in light of the order that was recently issued by the federal courts in the prison overcrowding litigation that's going on here in California. So really a lot of question marks, and it's really not clear what's going to happen. I want to make a point, though, about these population reduction plans in other states and in California, and just be clear that often when public officials talk about reducing prison populations, they're not necessarily talking about opening up the doors and releasing tens of thousands of prisoners. The plan that the governor put forth for reducing the budget, as well as the order issued recently in the overcrowding litigation, call for population reductions, which, as you've mentioned, involve a lot of different policies, such as increasing the amount of credit that prisoners can receive while they serve their time, diverting some low-risk nonviolent offenders into non-incarcerative alternatives. So it's not as though anyone's proposing opening the doors to the California prisons and releasing 40,000 inmates tomorrow.
But they're supposed to cut the population by 40,000 in something like 2 years. I mean, you can't do that just by slow attrition. That's nearly a third of the state's prison population.
Right. So the order included some recommendations that the court had for the state in terms of how it might go about reducing its population by the required 40,000, and ordered the state to come up with a plan within 45 days of the order. So we'll see what the governor comes up with.
Let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia, and Ray. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm a retired warden from New York State.
Okay.
And here in Virginia, we have, there's a creative way of reducing prison population. One of them is the aging out of inmates, whereas I believe that the recidivism rate for inmates over 50 years of age released back into the community is below 5%. Nationally, those figures are 67 to 70% naturally. And the formula being age plus time served equals release. And it's a fairly effective program, and the potential for recidivism and reoffending over the age of 50 or 55 is very minimal. So that's one of the creative ways to reduce.
Interesting. So why keep guys or women in prison if they're over 50 and the statistics show very not likely to reoffend?
Yeah, well, crime is pretty much a young man's game. There's not too many people in their 50s jumping out a window with a television set or burglarizing
mm-hmm.
a house or
mm-hmm.
holding up gas stations. You know, if you look at your average prison population, I believe the lion's share of the population is between the age of 21 and 30, you know, in the 20s. That's been my experience. So certainly it doesn't serve any purpose after a period of time.
Yeah.
If someone doesn't have criminal potential to be released back into the community.
And as a former warden, you know of what you speak. Thank you, Ray. Mark Maurer, what about it? Are you looking at creative answers like that or at fundamental sentencing reform? Where do you see the main possibility for reducing the populations and some of the cost of those populations without risking a spike in crime?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things is looking at how the system functions. And, you know, when a judge is considering what kind of sentence to impose, send someone to prison or keep them on probation, a difficult decision, there are financial issues involved. If you send them off to prison, the state pays for it. If you keep them in the county on probation, then generally the county pays for it. So in some ways, there's a built-in incentive to send more people to prison. Now, it doesn't say that this necessarily influences a judge's decision. decision in a given case, but it is out there. And what some states are beginning to look at, Kansas, Arizona, is to basically say the state will provide some financial incentive to the county to keep more people under county community supervision. So essentially, if you can reduce the number of people you're sending state prison, you get some money. You can use that money to invest in probation officers, in job placement services, treatment programs, whatever it takes to assure that you've got appropriate supervision, appropriate connections for that defendant in the community. And that way, the state saves some money from incarceration. Hopefully, you avoid the negative consequences of incarceration, separation from family and community for the offender. And if you can use that as a way to keep someone in the community, keep them productive, you know, that should be a win-win situation all around.
Well, Karadansky, you've now got out of Chino, I think, something like 1,000 prisoners who have to be bused elsewhere because that place is, a bunch of it is burned down. I mean, can you really just shove the state prison population into county facilities and escape the budget issue here? It may be for the state, but then the county's got the bill.
Well, that's an important point, and it's true that with the Chino riot, California state prisons lost another approximately 1,000 beds. So, you know, we were already in trouble, and now we're in bigger trouble. What a lot of counties will say, counties meaning sheriffs, the people who run the jails, and probation officers, will say that they are already strapped. You know, not only is the state strapped, but county budgets are also strapped. And many California county jails are also under federally imposed population reduction orders. So a lot of the county facilities will say they don't have the room for it, and they will say that bringing in all of these state inmates will require them to release some of their county inmates. So it's a very complicated picture.
Let's go to Patrick in Hartford, Connecticut. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hello. I just have three quick comments. I'll try and make them brief.
Yes, sir.
I've worked in law enforcement for many years, so this is my perspective. First is I know all the academics want to talk about the prison overcrowding, and I agree it's a problem and there's no easy answer. But I see on a daily basis individuals with 10, 12, or more felony convictions that are still out in the street.
Yep.
And when these individuals do reoffend, the community cries out that, why aren't they in prison? And we kind of can't have it both ways.
Yep.
And comment two is, in my experience, probation and parole is absolutely ineffective. There is totally inadequate supervision and constant and persistent reoffending going on during probation and parole, most of which is never caught.
Okay.
And third is, I take issue with the characterization of nonviolent drug offenders. I think a better way to describe it is drug possessor versus drug distributor. There are a number, I mean, it's pretty frequent that we have individuals who are selling large amounts of drugs that just happen to not be violent, and to just classify them as a nonviolent drug offender, that it's a meaningless offense when they're selling thousands and thousands of dollars of crack cocaine and heroin in the streets versus someone who has a little bag in their pocket.
And a lot of violence may swirl around that activity. Patrick, thank you very much for your perspective. Our time is short before the break here, and Mark Maurer, I know we're going to lose you, but what about it? Patrick says, look, we can't have it both ways. I've seen reports come out that said our democratic process is in no small part behind these big numbers because voters, you know, want people locked up. And you've got people even in academia in the Stanford Law and Policy Review. I'm reading here from Kent Scheidegger and Michael Rushford, writing, the simple truth is that imprisonment works. Locking up criminals for longer periods reduces the level of crime. The benefits of doing so far offset the costs. What do you say, Mark?
I think voters want us to do something about crime, public safety. You know, obviously, that makes certain good sense. I think what politicians have read in that is that voters want tougher sentences, more prisons. And if you look just a little bit deeper, what you find is voters are quite willing to make distinctions. California is a very good example. 1994, the Three Strikes Initiative on the state ballot had some 70% of the people supporting it. They believed that was to lock up three-time violent offenders for life. It turned out not quite that way, but that's what they thought. Mm. 6 years later, the same public in California voted a significant majority for Proposition 36, an initiative to divert lower-level drug offenders into treatment rather than prison. So I think the public is more sophisticated than many political leaders make it out to be, that Yes, they want to use prison for people who represent a threat to them, but they're receptive to doing more constructive things for people who have underlying substance abuse problems, mental health issues, and the like. And so we need to stretch out those choices, and we need to take advantage more of both cost-effective and more compassionate ways to address some of these issues.
Mark Maurer with the Sentencing Project in Washington. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about California's Chino prison riot last weekend. It was bloody, fire, real destruction there, looking at the challenge in hard times of paying the cost of huge prison populations nationwide. Chino, designed for about 3,000 inmates, had almost double that number. The U.S. last year, for the first time in its history, saw more than one in every 100 American adults behind bars. For some groups, rates even higher. One in 36 adult Hispanic men behind bars. One in 15 adult black men. One in 9 black men aged 20 to 34. We've got high rates, by far the highest in the world, by far. And it is expensive. On average, states spend about 7% of their budgets on corrections, trailing only health care and education and transportation. Costs something like $23,000 a year to imprison someone in 05. Varies by state, $45,000 a year in Rhode Island to keep a prisoner, $13,000 a year in Louisiana. Kara Dansky has joined us from the Stanford Criminal Justice Center. She's executive director there and joins us from Berkeley, California. Right now from Houston, Texas, we're joined by Byron Price. He's associate professor of political science at Texas Southern University. He's interim director of the Barbara Jordan Institute for Policy Research. He's author of the book Merchandising Prisoners, Who Really Pays for Prison Privatization. Byron Price, thank you very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's a big, expensive picture we're looking at. What part does the privatization of so much of America's correctional system play in all this?
Well, I think that's a great question. When you take into consideration that Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest for-profit prison corporation, had a $2 billion market cap. Looking at Yahoo Finance, and then you think about the Geo Group has 961 million market cap. So when you take into consideration these for-profit prison corporation lobby through the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a conservative think tank that brings forth privatization legislation, and about a third or more of our state legislators sit on the American Legislative Exchange Council Criminal Justice Task Force Committee, and these for-profit prison corporations fund the operational budget of the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they get seats on the Criminal Justice Task Force Committee with those state legislators who they contribute campaign finance to. In the 2000 election cycle, they brought forth those truth and sentencing legislation, and like 25 states passed truth and sentencing legislation, habitual offender legislation, they opened up prison industry. So a lot, and even communities' livelihoods are tied to incarceration. So as they build prisons, the only way they make money is to put bodies in those prisons.
Of course, Professor Price, if the private corporations, it may be profitable, it may make them valuable companies, but if they can do it more cheaply than state-run institutions, I suppose nobody cares.
Well, but see, that's the thing. The first, they don't do it cheaper. The studies out there on both sides, they claim they can do it cheaper, but one of the things that's not factored in is that the state has the monitor. The state pays for all the transportation costs, any major health-related costs the states pick up. And when you take into consideration that a lot of states draw bad contracts, and I think there are a lot of things, a lot of hidden costs. Even some of them get a lot of subsidies and infrastructure subsidies, tax abatements. So do they really provide it cheaper when you factor in all those hidden costs? And the answer is no. And one of the first things they do is cut labor costs. So when you think about the Chino incident, then by paying less money to private correction officers, then you're more likely to get a less qualified correction officer. They spend less money on pre-service training also for their correction officers.
Kara Dansky, if I may go to you in Berkeley for just a moment. Excuse me, Byron Price. But, Kara, I mean, we see this interesting cross currents around the country, because communities become dependent on prisons as economic engines, especially in tough times. I mean, we're looking at, in Michigan, the Standish Maximum Correctional Facility up northeastern Michigan, competing to get the prisoners from Guantanamo Bay that others said they didn't want, because they want somebody to keep in that prison to keep it open and running. It's an economic factor.
That's right. In a lot of areas, incarceration actually is quite profitable for the state and for the surrounding communities. And Professor Price is right to point out that has become a really significant issue, really. In California, of course, it's important to point out that most of the state's 33 prisons have been built only in the last few decades. So California went along for a very long time, for the first 150 or so years of its existence, with a very small number of prisons. In fact, it's worth pointing out that Chino was built in the 1940s specifically in order to reduce crowding at San Quentin and Folsom, the mm-hmm. only two prisons that existed before that time. So this massive prison expansion that we've seen in the last few decades has a number of important dynamics that we've only begun recently to unravel, one of those being the incentive that these institutions create for increasing incarceration.
That's a tough picture, I mean, especially when the state officials are looking. I mean, here's an Arizona official joking about their state's financial plight comparable to the Grand Canyon. An Illinois legislator, this is in a CNN story, saying their budget situation is so scary it's best told around a campfire at night. But then crime is scary, too. Let's go to Tom in Columbus, Georgia. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
A lot of the talk here seems to be about how much it's costing, you know, to house all of the prisoners. And I think about 5 years ago or so, incident that was in the news, and it was, I think it was either in Arizona or New Mexico. It was a local sheriff down there. And he had set up a tent city, so to speak.
Oh, this is the famous Maricopa County sheriff. Yes, that's right.
Yes. And and some people cried foul, saying that was inhumane to have the prisoners to live that way. And I totally disagree with that. I'll use myself as an example. I did 4 years in the military, mm-hmm. and I was infantry. And I did a tour of duty in Iraq in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And at times, we didn't have a tent. We just dug a hole and lived in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point when we were in Iraq, we went 3 months without a shower because, you know, logistically it wasn't possible at that point. You know, people, you'd go back 150 years ago where they were having cattle drives and things like that, you know, the cattle drive didn't stop because, you know, the environment got austere because it was cold and wet and rainy and things like that. I think that if they were to go back to build, you know, they build these multi-million-dollar prisons, and these prisoners, you know, they gave up their rights to have all the luxuries of life because they chose to break the law. But yet they're put in these nice pristine buildings where they're air-conditioned and they live in complete comfortability year-round. And that seems to be where a lot of the cost is going, is just these multi-million dollar buildings.
Tom, let us pick it up. I think we've got your point, and I appreciate it. Kara Dansky, first to you. I'm sure there are some facilities, like Tom describes. I'm also reading here about very overcrowded facilities where, like, old gyms are filled with triple-deck bunks wall-to-wall. The square foot per prisoner has been reduced. But you hear Tom's point. Look, if our military is going to sleep in foxholes, would tent cities be good enough for our giant prison population? Maybe, you know, the answer to the cost is just to make the conditions rougher. I don't know. Put them outside.
Right. Some of the references I think you're referring to in terms of gymnasiums may, in fact, come from California, where there has been litigation on the issue of overcrowding, and the court has recently made some factual findings about the extent of overcrowding and the effect of overcrowding on the conditions. One of the major issues in this litigation has to do with the effect of overcrowding on causing conditions that have actually reached such alarming proportions that they have been found to be unconstitutionally deplorable, really. It is true that a lot of the prisons are newer, as I was pointing out. Many of them have been built just recently in the last few decades. We do still operate, however, some very old prisons. San Quentin is still in operation, as is Folsom. And the question really when it comes to conditions has to do at some point with a legal question, which is, are the conditions, are they so bad that they violate the Constitution? They have been found to be so bad here in California. The other question has to do with really the extent to which we have chosen to use incarceration as a mechanism of punishment. And I think the main thing to keep in mind are just the sheer numbers of people that we're choosing to incarcerate and how that number has increased over time. We are choosing to incarcerate more and more people for things that we never would have imagined incarcerating people for 100 or 150 years ago. And another point I just wanted to make, you've mentioned a few times that crime, of course, is scary. And so when we talk about the cost of incarceration, we need to look at the cost of crime, too.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is completely true. And one thing that I don't think we've talked enough about is the extent to which increasing studies are showing that prison actually has an effect in increasing crime in many ways. If you look at it on a local level, what the data shows is that in communities where increasing numbers of people are being sent to jail in prison, crime in those communities goes up. And it is also true nationally. We are finding that and of course, this is reflected in our recidivism rates, that once people leave prison, they are nowadays more likely than not to return there. And there is speculation that it's actually the conditions in prison that are causing these increasing crime rates. It's another factor that we need to consider when we look at the relationship between incarceration and crime rates.
But people point, in the last 20 years, according to the FBI, rates of violent crime in this country fell by 25%. That's in the same period of time that our prison population was skyrocketing. So people say, well, look, that's a pretty good drop in violent crime.
That's right. And what the studies are showing is that there is increasing agreement that drop in violent crime, that approximately a quarter of that reduction in violent crime is attributable to incarceration, and that three quarters of that drop in violent crime is attributable to factors that have nothing to do with incarceration or, in fact, criminal justice policy at all. It has to do with the economy that was thriving in the 1990s and low unemployment rates and high wages and things like that. And even more recent studies are showing that incarceration has even less of an effect on reducing crime rates than we once thought. So it is absolutely true that if we lock up more and more people, that will have an effect on reducing crime rates. It's just a question of how much of an effect those increasing incarceration rates have, and secondly, whether it's worth it.
And of course, a lot of the rest of the world looks at us and shakes their heads. They have far lower prison populations and far lower crime. Byron Price, how do you look at this in Houston? I mean, can this country, we're looking at our economy now, we're looking at state budgets that are really in trouble. Can we afford our incarceration rates in this country, Byron?
Well, I don't think so. And I think you go back to the point where they talk about the tents and so forth, putting them in there. But you're putting low-risk, low-level offenders in there with hardened criminals. I think some of the things that we could do, for example, is a lot of the low-level offenders, move them into diversion programs, but also remove the collateral consequences of a felony conviction. I mean, if you have a drug conviction, you can't get public assistance. Okay, you can't stay in public housing with your family when you get out. You can't get some vocational licenses are affected by that. You can't get to cut someone's hair. I mean, like the Higher Education Act of 1988 had a drug provision attached to it. You couldn't get financial aid. But I think in 2005 they had an amendment when you were in, if you were in school and you committed an offense, you couldn't get financial aid. So, and think about when you can't pay child support arrears. So then because it goes up so high when you're in jail, then your driver's license is suspended. So I think there are a lot of things that we could help low-level nonviolent offenders. I think that's, to me, that's part of the problem. I mean, there's so much money being made off of commissaries and cottage industries developing around the prison industry that people are being their probation and paroles are being violated. They can't make restitution, pay $20 restitution because they can't find a job because they say, have you ever been convicted of a felony? You checked on the employment box, yes, and you're automatically thrown out of the pool. So I think if we were smart about reintegrating people back into society, see, I'm concerned about nonviolent, low-risk offenders. I think that's where we could really make inroads there because once you remove them, then the family has, they lose their income. And when they're in jail, although they make billions of dollars off of their labor, they get paid pittance. I mean, they don't make any money. So we have to think about how we treat the formerly incarcerated.
And the family's in trouble outside. Let me get one more call from Nashville, Tennessee. David, you're on the air.
David from Nashville. Was a former chaplain at the old Tennessee State Penitentiary and worked in corrections a number of years in the Department of Correction. Doing a documentary, by the way, about that 20 years from 1972 to 1992. Mm-hmm. The issue is a systemic question. The question is that is prison a place of punishment or rehabilitation? I think that's the wrong question. The question or the statement is that prison is a place of exile. We send people away to get them away from us and to keep us from hurting them mm-hmm. as much as them hurting us. Now, if you have prison as a place of exile, the question then is what behaviors warrant exile? The other question following from that is how long will the exile last? Number three are what are the conditions of exile? Will they be redemptive or punitive? Will they be constitutional and humane, or will they be other than that? When it's other than that, the courts will step in. The next one question down the line is what are the conditions for release? And the next question is how will people be received upon release?
David, our time is short. Do you think, very short, do you think the cost of this imprisonment in itself is going to force this kind of consideration or reconsideration in this country?
The last question is the cost issue. How much are we willing to pay for it? Now, when the courts step in, they become settlers of the question. It took, and I use this with a small s, it took federal judge Thomas Higgins to step in and mandate certain things. Tennessee now is maybe one of the few, if only, states to be accredited with all of its institutions by the American Correctional Association. That could not have occurred without the federal court stepping in and mandating changes.
David, our time is short here. I apologize, but Karadansky, last word to you. Do you think that sheer economics are likely to change American sentencing and incarceration policy?
Well, there are a number of factors that we need to be looking at, and I would point in particular to a speech that the Attorney General recently gave the American Bar Association, in which he really encouraged us to think about whether we can continue to rely on incarceration as the primary mechanism of punishment in our society, and to really begin to talk openly about what policies work and what policies don't work. Part of that conversation will absolutely involve a question about the money that we're spending, and part of the conversation will involve other questions such as how we intend to treat our prisoners.
That's a big picture. We saw it in flames in Chino last weekend, and I appreciate all the insights we've had here today. Karadansky at the Stanford Criminal Justice Center, thank you very much for joining us today, Ms. Dansky.
Thanks for having me.
And Byron Price in Houston, Texas at Texas Southern University, author of Merchandising Prisoners. Professor Price, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.